Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Jennifer Waits.
Hello, everybody. I'm Eric Klein.
And I'm Paul Riesmandel.
On the show today, we're talking about queer spaces and queer community on the radio and in podcasting, specifically lesbian broadcasters in Canada. Our guest today is Stacey Copeland. She's a media producer and PhD candidate at Simon Fraser University School of Communication in Vancouver, Canada. Stacey is producer of the Spoken Web podcast about literary sound and also produces the scholarly Amplify podcast network. This might ring a bell with listeners as we discuss both projects with Hannah McGregor on Radio Survivor episodes 275 and 284. We're very excited to welcome Stacey Copeland on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. As just mentioning, I was listening to your Michelle Hilmes episode just before I logged on. So I feel like I went from one Radio Survivor universe into the real one. So excited to be here. I do want to make one note. So I just finished my work with Spoken Web Podcast and handed over the reins as producer to the wonderful Judith Burr, which is giving me a bit more time to focus on the growing Amplify Podcast Network as well.
Yeah, you have so many projects that you're working on. So I'm not surprised that you might have to kind of shift focus here and there from time to time. Well, it's exciting to have you on the show. And I wanted to also say happy Pride because we're recording this episode on Friday, June 25th, towards the end of Pride Month. And your research focus is on lesbian radio, so it's perfect timing. And I wanted to see if we could start by having you define what lesbian radio is.
Sure. I mean, this is one of the key questions I ask everyone that I'm talking to in my research about lesbian radio. So for the most part, you know, we can go to the basic definitions of lesbian radio being radio that's produced by lesbians, for lesbians, and about lesbians. And when I'm talking about my research, we're also looking more broadly at queerness as well as the way people identify broaden outside of the historical lesbian and gay kind of binary in the homosexual world. Towards different nuances of queerness. So also thinking about what that sounds like when we're listening back as well.
And in Canada, is it common to have shows that are explicitly, that you would explicitly think about as lesbian radio?
Not anymore. So part of why I'm really interested in the subject matter of lesbian feminist and queer radio, as well as podcasting as well. So think about sound works like Michelle Hilmes on your show talks about, of course, is because we had this huge boom or decades long running shows in Canada that were very lesbian focused from the late 70s, early 80s into the 2010s, late 2010s. And then we saw a really interesting shift happen where a lot of those shows became amalgamated into the same shows that were for queer or gay specific genre. So a lot of shows in the 70s and 80s on community radio in Canada, we'd have the lesbian show, for instance, in Vancouver, and then we'd have the coming out show, which was primarily for gay men and then broader queer community. Those shows then got merged together once the lesbian show ended. Same thing happened in Montreal at CKUT, where we had Dykes on Mics, ended up merging with Queer Core, which was originally called The Homo Show, primarily about gay men. And those shows merged together into a more broader queer show once Dykes on Mics went off air as well.
It's interesting that historically you had more specificity in these shows and then they broadened. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's really interesting to look back on some of these dialogues around identity and politics. And I mean, the lesbian show was to my knowledge so far and my research so far, the earliest lesbian-focused radio show in Canada. It was started in 1979, and that was just a few years after community radio became a thing in Canada, that we even had community radio stations. Similar timeline in the US as well. And thinking about the establishment of community radio as a space for diverse voices that weren't in the commercial market, we started to see these shows emerge. And at the same time, we had, you know, large feminist movements, large queer equality movements happening all over the world, and I think in the US and in Canada too. So we had this kind of politics of visibility being taken up in the 70s and 80s with a lot of vigor. And we saw that in radio too. So the lesbian show was all about lesbian visibility. Hear it in the name. It's literally called The Lesbian Show. So that was their focus. It was about getting people just knowing that lesbians existed, because at the time there were still people who didn't know the term. They weren't familiar with it. It wasn't regular everyday language like it is today.
And sounds like these are principally shows then on campus community radio.
Yes. Yeah. So the two shows I'm particularly interested in at the moment, anyways, The Lesbian Show and Dykes on Mics, were both community radio shows, one without an affiliation with campus. So Vancouver Co-op Radio is specifically a nonprofit co-op community radio station. And then Dykes on Mics was out of CKUT, which is connected to McGill University in Montreal.
Got it. And I know this isn't necessarily the mainstream of your research, but do you know, I mean, was there much incidence of programming by and for lesbians on commercial radio, let's say just in Canada?
On commercial radio, no. So there's very, very few far between commercial stations for gays and lesbians, LGBTQ community in general. Pride FM in Toronto is one of very few, but it was started decades later. It certainly wasn't being operated at the time that these shows were first on air.
Yeah,
and how about specific radio shows? I know that in the United States, there have been commercial radio stations that might have more niche programming on the weekends, for example. And in some cases, there might be an LGBTQ-focused show on a commercial station. So was that something that you were ever aware of in Canada?
Not that I'm super aware of. I mean, if people know of some, I would be so excited to hear about it. So please reach out. But yeah, I mean, Pride FM was born in the commercial radio station market because of a lack of that content in that market in Canada. And then with CBC Radio, it was usually just single night specials or limited run series versus long-term shows. They do have a podcast now, Chosen Family, which is one of the first ones in Canada for them to have that is an ongoing series.
I mean, this makes me think about, there's a long-running syndicated community radio show, maybe carried in Canada, certainly common in the US, called This Way Out. Again, not specifically, sort of generally for the queer community, and not specifically for lesbians in particular, but definitely itself, you know, very much an independent, syndicated kind of program, very grassroots, and nothing at all, certainly not commercially funded by any stretch.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that, which I love, but I think I'm really interested in looking at the niche of lesbian, and I say lesbian feminist work because at the time in the 70s and 80s, that's how they defined themselves. Lesbian feminist work, because they didn't last. But I do feel like we're starting to see a resurgence of interest in more identity-centric media across the board, not just in radio and podcasting, but in all of the media we consume that we just hadn't really seen over the last few decades. And so I'm interested to see if that shifts, you know, some of the community and independent work that we start to see as well out of the broad umbrella category of LGBTQ, say news shows or current event shows like This Way Up.
And speaking of lesbian media, I think it's super interesting at Simon Fraser that there's this project, The Archives of Lesbian Oral Testimony. And has this play? Well, first of all, tell us about that. I have a feeling that it's played a big part in your work. So tell us what the Archives of Lesbian Oral Testimony, what that is.
Yeah, very near and dear to my heart. So the Archives of Lesbian Oral Testimony was started by Elle Chenier, who is a historian at Simon Fraser University. And it's an online archive for the most part. There are physical archival materials that are housed at SFU. The initiative is really about bringing those stories, those pieces of media, those conversations out into the public. And so I came across that website a few years before I started my PhD research, and it really was a big part of why I got interested in the subject matter. It was the first time that I came across The Lesbian Show or had ever heard of it. I had never seen it in publications before. And as someone who's studying queer media and studying feminist media, I was surprised that I had never heard about this show that had been on air for decades. So I was interested in listening to it and listening to some of the early files that they had in there from mostly the early 90s. I could hear myself in those, and that was really powerful for me. You know, listening to other people talk about their queer experiences, talking about community, I felt like it was something I could hear on air today, but it was from 1992, you know? So that really got me thinking about those connections, about talking to people from the past who are making these shows and seeing how it reflects or might shape how we make media moving forward.
So maybe talk more about what all is in those archives.
Oh gosh, there's so much. So the Lesbian Show archive is just one of many files you can find. There's a bunch of oral history recordings. There's videos. There are also links to, I believe they have a connection to a leather fetish museum in the US too.
Quite the range.
Yeah, so there's a ton of stuff in here. Yeah, so they have some connections with, I believe that one's in Chicago. And then a few collections from Bold Fest, which is for older lesbians. They've run a couple of events and conferences, for instance, for older lesbians. So they have an archive of work from that initiative. They have a collection that's all about women's music and Canadian women in particular making women's music, and then the Lesbian Show as well.
And so when you started diving into this archive, is that what prompted your PhD research idea? Was it sparked by the archive, or did you turn to the archive when you started doing your research, or how do you, which came first, maybe is the question.
A chicken or egg situation.
Exactly.
Yeah. This one's always an interesting question to think through, because for me, it's so many layers. My undergrad was in radio production. So I have been a radio producer in the past. I've been a music producer. I worked as production assistant at the university that I graduated from for a while, helping other people learn how to make radio. And so that experience got me really thinking about women's roles and gendered roles in the audio production space. As someone really into tech, I often found myself up against some gendered barriers depending on what work situation I was in. And that got me thinking about what I could do about it. So I started, I co-founded a feminist radio collective through the Ryerson campus community radio station called Fem Radio at the time in 2016. And that project was just so much fun, just talking to other feminists, other people interested in gender politics and activism all over Canada with friends. So very casual chat style show, and then bringing in music and experimental work from time to time. But that project led me to my master's research, which was all about gendered voice and women's experiences of their voice on air. So that's really where the two came together. When I came across the Archive of Lesbian Oral Testimony, saw The Lesbian Show, had already been very invested in gendered politics on air, the two kind of came together in a really exciting way for me. Not to mention I'm a sound studies nerd, so that I could continue on studying sound and radio was awesome.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Like, what a find to have this whole collection on your campus, too. You know, it seems like there's a lot of respect for sound work at Simon Fraser. So it must be great to be in the midst of all of that.
Yeah, Simon Fraser University has just a wonderful history of sound studies in particular. And I'm part of that tradition at School of Communication, which has the history of R. Murray Schafer, who's a very well-known soundscape composer and also part of the World Soundscape Project, Barry Truax, who still, you know, haunts the hallways, if you will, as a professor emeritus. He's very active and always there to talk to us and support us as students and researchers at the university. Hildegard Westerkamp, I'm sure you've talked about on the show. And then, of course, my supervisor, Dr. Milena Drumeva, who's kind of taken over the legacy of the World Soundscape Project and continues to do active research in sound studies and the city.
And back to your project, it's interesting to me that you are a radio producer and you're also employing these feminist practices to your work. And I read that you're using the archives as part of your interview process when you're talking to some people who participated in some of these radio shows. Can you explain more about that, about how you're using archival audio in your research when you're talking to people that you're interviewing?
Yeah, I mean, because I want to partly recreate that experience that I first had in listening to The Lesbian Show for the first time. I think as radio producers, when we get to hear similar work or hear something that reflects ourselves in work from decades past, it really encourages us, you know, it gives us a sense that there is some sort of community or there is this sort of lineage that we are a part of. And that's hard to find sometimes when you're making maybe more niche work or you're coming from an experience or an identity position that isn't well represented in mainstream media. So listening back to some of these clips, so I can talk about it because they've already signed their waivers for my research. Talking to folks like Caitlin Press from The Heart, talking to folks from an initiative here called Procyon Network, Procyon Podcast Network, which is making more queer sci-fi shows out of Canada. And they don't explicitly identify as feminists, but they just all happen to be women and genderqueer folks making media about women and genderqueer folks. And then, of course, The Heart, which really does take an interesting queer feminist approach to all of the work that they make, but for a wider audience. So listening back to, say, clips from The Lesbian Show where they're experimenting with a limited series they did called Dykes in Space, where they play around with processing and they play around with the idea of all of them being in space together. Listening to that with people who are making sci-fi fiction podcasts today, centered on queer women's experiences, is just so heartwarming. And it really helps shift the conversation in interesting ways because you get some of that emotion, some of that, it's almost like icebreakers too, you know, it breaks down people's walls. It gets them thinking about their own position in the grander scheme of things in the radio world.
I love that you're drawing these connections between queer feminist radio from the past with podcasting today. And is that, it seems like your project is quite broad, you know, taking a deep dive into these historical shows, but also tying it to the future. Can you explain more about how you're handling the breadth of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it's big, but it's actually quite small in the grand scheme of things. There's not, especially in the Canadian context, not that many shows to look at in the first place. And unfortunately, not that many people from the shows that were started in the 70s and 80s that are around anymore or that are actively available or easy to contact because of the nature of community radio. People might only be on air for a few months at a time and then they're gone on to their next project. So it's often only the people who founded the show or were on air for decades that I get to talk to. And then same goes for podcasting. I mean, I'm always a bit saddened by the, you know, in Canada, we're overshadowed a bit by our sister to the south of the US when it comes to media. And podcasting is very much a space like that. Because there's so much content coming out of the US and coming out of the UK as well, when we're thinking about English language podcasts, that often the markets are already oversaturated for Canadian shows. And with less funding here, when we're thinking about not as many community radio stations, not as many large established podcast networks, there just isn't as much material. There isn't as many shows to study in the first place. So I'm hoping my research can help change that and really get people thinking about making shows that are rooted in where they are, that are rooted in Canadian experience.
I'd love to hear more about, you've just given these kind of tantalizing hints of some of these early shows with the sci-fi elements, et cetera. Maybe take us back. Let's see. I don't know if you want to start with a lesbian show or Dykes on Mics and talk more about the breadth of what was happening on one of those programs.
Yeah, sure. So the lesbian show I've been writing about quite recently, so it's a little more fresh in my mind. So the lesbian show out of Vancouver Co-op Radio is a magazine style show, which many community radio shows are. So for people who aren't familiar with that terminology, you know, there'd be an opening music segment of some sort, some banter off of the top, an introduction to who they might be speaking to on the show that day. Usually that banter.
We want to let listeners know that this was 1989, 1990, 1991.
Yes, definitely changed today. But thinking about, you know, their banter includes a lot of innuendo and speak about or kind of language that community is only going to understand, which I find really interesting in listening to, say, a show like The Lesbian Show compared to a lot of more larger mainstream media content around lesbian and queer identity. And then we'd have, you know, a music break, then the interview. Occasionally people would read poetry on air. And then they also had segments like Dykes in Space. For a while, they were running a radio drama as well. So it was called Against All Odds. And they had a 4-part radio drama that they did live on air on the lesbian show as well. So it was kind of whatever they wanted it to be, which is really interesting for me to study it because it's hard to put it into a single category sometimes.
You're alluding to this, like they're talking in, I forget what term you said, but it's sort of, they're talking in sort of insider language. Can you explain more about that?
Yeah, they're really talking in more of a queer vernacular. So talking about places or people that if you're not part of that community at the time or studying it like I am now, you might not really get some of the jokes that they're playing on or understand some of the events that they're talking about as well. One of the things, you know, it's June while we're having this conversation. Pride Month is also June here, but we have Pride celebrations in different months in different provinces and cities. But we often think of Stonewall, right, as the big event that kind of catalyzed June as Pride Month. But in Canada, we have similar events that happened, like Operation Soap, which was hundreds of men who got rounded up in Toronto, that was in a different month, and that's not where Pride is. But they might talk about these things as if they are common knowledge because they were in the communities at the time.
I just learned that there was a protest in Los Angeles 2 years before Stonewall at surrounding a club called the Black Cat. That was the first outwardly gay street protest for the same reasons, to protest police brutality in gay clubs 2 years prior to Stonewall in New York City.
Yeah, it's really interesting what sort of events get catalyzed or put up onto pedestals versus others, for sure.
And then how about, so that was the lesbian show. How about Dykes on Mics? Maybe you give us a bit of a backstory about that show.
Yeah, so Dykes on Mics, the lesbian show tended to be a bit more news focus. They had a news segment always, just like most magazine style shows do, like an events and news segment at the end. Dykes on Mics started out that way from my knowledge, but ended up being more of a casual chat style show by the end. So in the last few decades of it, they would often have hosts primarily just doing banter, bringing on their friends, talking about what's going on in their lives. Deb Van Slitt, who was on air for quite a few years on Dykes on Mics, for instance, would just happen to talk to a lesbian in the street who, say, was a plumber and bring them on air and talk about what it was like to be a lesbian plumber in the early 90s. So these are the kinds of different conversations you would get compared to what was happening at the lesbian show, where it seems like there was a larger variety of work happening versus Dykes on Mics was very much community rooted. It was about who are the people in our community who are lesbians, who just happen to be lesbians, right? What is that experience like for them? And then later, a lot of the hosts were very involved in, of course, queer activism in Montreal. And so they would bring on event organizers, other activists, and have those sort of long form interview discussions with, you know, little musical breaks in between as well.
Stacey Copeland, I'm fascinated by the fact that you have these archives to begin with of the lesbian show and Dykes on Mics, because it seems that in community radio in particular, those archives can be hard to come by, and if shows were recorded often, that means they're in a shoebox or a closet or a storage space that the producer had, you know, tucked away of cassettes. Do you have any sense of why and how these shows got preserved in the first place?
Great question. Yeah. And I mean, when you're talking about queer community, that's an even bigger issue, because there was and still is a lot of distrust of government and institutional organizations and giving your files, your histories to them to look after, when we've had so many issues in the past of those files then being burned or lost or put somewhere else and never quite given the platform that they deserve. So, I mean, that's partly why the Archive of Lesbian Oral Testimony was established. It's a long history, just like in the US, of queer archives being established outside of institutions by community to make sure that we get these histories collected and stored. I mean, I gotta say, I am super lucky that not only with archives, the Archive of Oral Testimony, the Vancouver Archive, City of Vancouver Archive, which is now home to the BC Gay and Lesbian Archives, just received and digitized, just finished digitizing last year, I believe, a whole other collection of lesbian show tapes, which I didn't even know existed, because I started researching this at a time where the BC Gay and Lesbian Archives were in transition. So those archives used to be in someone's house, Ron Dutton. He literally started it in the 70s. The BC Gay and Lesbian Archives started in the 70s. It was just run out of his house. And he then donated all of those files. So for a while, no one really knew what was in them until the City of Vancouver Archives finally started cataloging and digitizing everything. So you can even go listen to those now. Those are all online, which is awesome. And then Dykes on Mics, I only have because I got a box of tapes from one of my interviewees.
Wow. Wow. And what's also, I think, got to be a delightful experience for you, you know, you sort of mentioned how, you know, the Dykes on Mics series started out one way and sort of progressed, and to be able to actually listen to that progression of how the show's developed, which is both, I think, form as well as content, because for the person who was experiencing it in real time, unless they themselves were actually recording it, it's kind of a change that might go unnoticed. You know, someone might say, hey, I remember, you know, year ago, 2 years ago, they used to do this thing and they did this segment. I wish they'd do it, or I wish they, you know, whatever. But in most cases, I think it's hard to perceive as it's happening, and you're getting to sort of listen in on a development because you're doing it post facto because you have the tapes. I'm wondering, you know, What's that experience like? And do you perceive, what do you perceive maybe informs those kind of shifts? You know, do you think it's, you know, because it can be sometimes because there is a kind of a dialogue of sorts with audience, and sometimes it's the dialogue of the people producing it, right? The folks who may come and go.
Yeah, I mean, it's a complex question. So I think partly in what I'm finding in my research, I think it has to do, of course, with the shift to there being the internet. So there was a larger valuing of community radio in a pre-internet era because not everyone could make their own media. Not everyone could make their own podcast in their bedroom. It was a privilege, really, to be in those spaces. And it was an institution in that sense for giving voice to people who otherwise couldn't get their stories out there, that stories that weren't getting told in the mainstream, versus when we're talking about the early 2000s, where we're really starting to see a lot of these shifts take place, we're not seeing the same valuing of community radio, I think, because there's so many other ways to get your voice out there, to get your story out there now than there was back then. And it also has to do with, you know, classic volunteer burnout. These organizations in Canada are nonprofits. They're primarily run and operated by volunteers and a small skeleton staff that is not paid enough for what they do. And that means that people come and go and we lose a lot of that form. I think, you know, to give contemporary community radio a break, I think it also has to do with when we're listening to things from the early 80s on community radio, the only model that they really had was the CBC here, public radio. And so they were mimicking what they thought radio should sound like. There wasn't a lot of other examples versus, you know, once we've had a few decades of community radio to be whatever it wants to be, we start to see more loose forms taking shape.
That makes me think about when you yourself were doing campus community radio a bit later and you hadn't heard some of these programs. So when you were doing a feminist radio collective, what were you calling upon in your mind as far as your radio inspiration?
Yeah, for sure it was traditional radio formats when we're talking about public radio at CBC here, because myself being, I was in the media production, which at the time was called Radio and Television Arts degree. And then my co-founder, Emily Javeski, was a journalism student. So we were coming from a very formalized radio production background. Podcasting was established. It was out. This is 2016. It existed. We even put out Fem Radio as a podcast, just like you do with Radio Survivor. So we had a sense of, you know, different forms we could take with it. And it did mean we did some more experimental things on it, but it did take exactly the same sort of magazine style format because that's what we thought it should sound like. It should have an opening musical piece. It should have an intro to the hosts and what we're going to talk about today. So we just fell into that form, I think, because it was what we were used to listening to.
And I'm curious, you know, since you're looking at this historically, what do you see in podcasts and lesbian podcasts today? And is there similarity back with these early lesbian radio shows? Because I think it's fascinating and kind of sad that you talked about how these very specific lesbian shows existed and then they got sort of morphed into more generalized queer radio shows. So are you seeing more specific lesbian shows again in the podcasting realm?
Yeah, not a ton, but more than the none that existed. So so with folks like at the Procyon Podcast Network making shows that are queer sci-fi, women and genderqueer centered shows, and The Heart really thinking about how we can bring lesbian and queer feminist ideas and identities into mainstream audio work, we are starting to see some of those conversations being taken up again, but in very different ways, because they're not stories that are necessarily rooted in the local, in the community that they're being created in. They're being created for a global listenership, for a broad listenership that's maybe interested in the story and identity, but not necessarily interested in the connections to, say, a small town in Canada.
That's really interesting to think about these historic shows that were hyper-local. And do you have a sense that that's something that is just not as common anymore, to have a hyper-local show about queer culture?
Yeah, there's a few. And I mean, Queer FM, for instance, out of UBC's community campus radio station, has been on air for decades as well, from the 90s. And those folks are doing amazing work. But again, a more broader queer show. And there's quite a few of those. You can usually find one at every community station in Canada for the most part, until somebody leaves and it's on hiatus for a while. But yeah, I think we're starting to see a lot more interesting local focused shows start to emerge. For instance, there's one in the US, Country Queers, which is out of the US and really showcases rural queer folks and their lives. And it is just an amazing podcast, fairly recent, and they're doing great work. And I think we are starting to see some more interest in getting back to community, but it is a struggle. And I think it relates also to a lot of the discussions that are happening in broader queer community about closures of physical spaces as well. So a lot of queer bars, lesbian bars being closed over the past few years, even more so because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I think that translates and echoes the same experiences that are happening in community radio, where there just isn't the same sort of importance on local community. But I think it is changing. I think it comes in ebbs and flows. I mean, I'm not a historian myself. I consider myself more like a media theorist who has a real appreciation for history. But when we're looking back, and what historians always tell us is that history tends to repeat itself. So I think we're seeing that happen again.
Stacey, do you think that the lack of an example of a more community-based or hyper-local podcast is sort of self-perpetuating, that the folks see the model as something which is sort of national or global in scope and just presume that, and it takes someone to kind of go, wait a minute, and break the mold?
I think it takes, and it's awful to say, but I think it takes someone breaking the mold and making money at it. Unfortunately, in the world that we live in. And that's one of the biggest frustrations for folks who are making queer and feminist media right now, is that the feminist collective ethos does not pair well with capitalism. So I think what often happens is you have to be thinking a bit broad. You look at examples that have done well, like Nancy, even though Nancy is now off air, so maybe not the best example anymore. But shows like Nancy, shows like The Heart, that are taking broader ideas of experience and of queerness and of human aspect that podcasting is so good at, taking those aspects, and they're doing well at it. So people are trying to mimic the same form for sure.
It's such a different landscape now, where I'm just thinking about representation, that we have queer representation across all sorts of mainstream media. And so I'm sure that that plays a part in some of what you're talking about. And, you know, you talked earlier about queer spaces, physical spaces, you know, like bars, but also that radio or podcast can be queer spaces. And maybe speak to that, you know, what's the importance of having kind of a queer-directed queer space versus queers within a space that's more mainstream?
Yeah, I mean, this is something I think we're starting to see a huge resurgence of, even in mainstream media, initiatives that are, and we can thank large movements like Black Lives Matter for this, you know, large resurgences of industry saying, oh, you know, maybe white dudes shouldn't be making all of the biggest decisions in our network. Maybe there should be a bit more variety of people making decisions on our large projects that are going out for all of, say, in the US, all Americans to hear, when they maybe, you know, a bunch of white dudes, not to knock only on white dudes, but a bunch of white dudes can't necessarily understand how other listeners who are Black, who are from other, you know, class systems, for instance, will listen to that work. They might not know what they want to listen to. So having a variety of those voices, I think, is starting to be of interest to not only niche community radio stations, but to all media stations. And it should be. And that's exciting because it will mean, you know, if we keep doing it, we've, again, seen this happen before. And then we think, hooray, problem solved. And then we start all over again. But thinking, you know, that could lead to some really interesting work being done. But I think before that work can continue on, people have to start getting used to listening to stories that they maybe aren't used to listening to. And that's going to take time. That's going to take repetition for that to happen, for sure.
Stacey Copeland, you're with us today on Radio Survivor because we've been talking about some archives that you studied that were of lesbian shows from the late 80s and early 90s. And you're also a podcaster, and we've been talking about queer podcasting and lesbian podcasting. The archives of the community radio shows, I'm wondering if you could talk more about what lessons you want people who are making radio now or podcasts, because it's the same thing, to get from the past. Like, why care about these old shows? What do they have to teach us?
Yeah. Oh, so one of the things I'm really interested in, especially right now when identity politics, I feel like, is a very hot topic when it comes to media representation. You can talk about media representation better now and with anyone than I think you could decades before. And, you know, you say people who are queer or people who are Black should be making their own media. And people are like, yeah, that sounds reasonable. But I think what we can take from listening back to shows, especially community radio shows in Canada from the 70s and 80s, is also their structural and production choices. So not only were we having these folks, you know, queer folks making queer media for queer folks, by queer folks, right? But they were also really experimenting with what that looked like structurally. So thinking about what were some of the catalysts that created community radio in the first place at the time? What might we learn from those socially informed structural changes when it comes to media? How might that help us rethink the current issues we're having now with getting voices out there that maybe aren't making the big bucks? Maybe we need to support those people in different ways that aren't driven just by dollar signs, right? And what would that kind of model look like? What does collective sharing of work look like? What does it mean to bring a bunch of community members in, train them up, and get them making audio together in dialogue with other media makers? Those are the kinds of things that I think we can start to see taking shape in the 70s and 80s that we should start thinking more about today.
Yeah, I really like that idea because there's, I can't think of any models, you know, that like people could come together to make a podcast, to make the podcast together, not to monetize the podcast or Patreon to the moon, the podcast, but to put your voices out there collectively, which was, you know, the default of community radio in the 80s and 90s, and not the default of podcasting at this time.
Yeah, I do think, of course, we have to think about the reality we're living in now is different, and people are hesitant to do things that don't pay them and take up a lot of time, and so we have to factor that
in the cities, like mm-hmm. really the people that got to make community radio in the 80s and 90s didn't have to, there wasn't as much pressure to make their rent as there is now. I mean, it's simple as that, I think.
Well, and back to this idea of practice and collectives, you know, it reminds me, we had a conversation with Monica De La Torre about a radio station in Yakima, Washington that had a feminist orientation to, you know, how some of the radio was produced. And I know that you think and write a lot about how some of this radio, how the practice of producing the show is feminist or queer. So maybe talk a bit about that and what you've learned about feminist and queer practice from looking back at these shows.
Yeah. I mean, feminist collectives are really fascinating to look at in different forms. And in Canada, we've had a few different big ones like Studio D, which was National Film Board. When we talk about filmmakers, for anyone who's nerdy and wants to look at feminist collective histories and media, it's a good one to look at. But in the radio scene, what I really love about reading and talking to folks from The Lesbian Show, for instance, who were very much rooting their radio work in a lesbian feminist politics, it was about, for them, thinking and taking the time to really reflect on whose voices were going to be in the show, but also who's listening. So for them, the show wasn't just for people in Vancouver. It was also for folks who were in rural communities who were picking up the airwaves, right? Picking up the broadcast in, say, Abbotsford, which is slightly big now, but was a very small rural town back then, who didn't have access to community at the time. So thinking about these folks living in rural communities, the only way that they can get any sort of lesbian news and lesbian community building is through listening to this show, because they can't get to the places easily to go be part of community. We talked a lot with my interviewees about safety too. So, you know, thinking even today, there's a lot of risk in being involved. There's a lot of risk involved in being queer, depending on the community that you're in or the place that you're in. But back then, it was pretty bad across the board in a lot of places. Vancouver was not the city it is now, for instance. And so there was a lot of risk involved in carrying around, say, an LGBTQ magazine on your person or showing up to an event that took a lot. And it could put your job at risk. It could put your life at risk. And so listening to the radio was a safe way for people to get involved, to hear that there was people like them out there. And so I think thinking about those concrete values and thinking broader about who you're serving, but also who you're involving, is a key aspect of feminist collective work. It's a very reflexive process. But of course, that means you need a lot of hands to be doing that, and you need a lot of time to be doing that, which are two things that is quite a struggle when it comes to community radio and volunteer work.
I'm really struck by the safe place that radio was providing. And we've talked to Brian DeShazer about this also. He has the Queer Radio Research Project. And I remember him describing some of these call-in shows where people would call in and basically come out over the air or, you know, ask questions that they don't have a community of people close at hand.
Brian DeShazer, friend of Radio Survivor, guest on Radio Survivor a handful of times, future guest, is now helping the This Way Out program, which has a really fascinating history in gay radio. When This Way Out was on the air in KPFK in Los Angeles, one of the founding producers said that they'd be on the air for, I don't remember if it was an hour or half an hour, but then they'd be taking calls from listeners for the next 2 hours at the station. That first it was on the air, and then they would just be getting off the air calls because they were the only resource. They'd be taking crisis calls from people. And this was probably in the Los Angeles listening area in the late 70s, early 80s, people who needed somebody to talk to about what was going on in their lives.
Yeah. Oh, I love Brian's work. I'm so excited by the work that he's doing for sure. And there's just such a rich history in the US of these types of shows too. I mean, the Lesbi Friends, I think, with San Francisco is again a long running lesbian radio show. So there's a ton of them in the US too.
Did you run across any call-in elements of these shows that you've been looking at so far, Stacey?
Oh, yeah. I mean, call-in is essential radio content, isn't it? I still feel like that's essential when you're looking at commercial radio in particular. Call-in culture is huge. It's how we relate to and know that people are listening when we're on air. One of my favorite things that the lesbian show did, for instance, was they had a Valentine's call-in show. So you could call in and say a lovely Valentine on air for the woman or person that you were having as your Valentine that year. And if you didn't want to have your voice on air or say your name in the sense of safety again, they would read it for you. And listening to that hour of Valentine's call-in content is just so, so wonderful.
That sounds incredibly sweet.
Yeah, it's adorable.
You know, you've mentioned the safety aspect of this. So I'm also wondering, like, on the downside, have you run across letters to some of these radio stations, or in your research, have you run across people who protested the very existence of some of these shows?
Not so much of these shows. I think it speaks a lot to, you know, community radio at the time was very niche, still is in Canada. Most people, you know, they do have solid listenerships, but CBC and commercial radio really dominates the radio industry here. So people, I think, were more concerned with protesting large queer movements, large queer protest events, there'd be backlash protests, rather than specifically targeting these stations. And I mean, the stations had the benefit of having a variety of content on air as well. These weren't just exclusively, you know, it wasn't a lesbian radio station in 1979. It also had a bunch of other content on it from across the community. And they really tried to make sure they positioned themselves as a place for everyone, for all community to be welcome, which I think helps.
Yeah, I would imagine that made it feel like an even safer space, that the entire radio station was a place for all sorts of people. So that could be a place where your voice was valued.
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, there was some pushback. The lesbian show, for instance, grew out of conflicts that the founders at the time were having with the men from the coming out show. And I don't think it was by accident that the programmer then scheduled the lesbian show to be the hour exactly after the coming out show. So they would have to run into each other when the one group was coming out of their broadcast and the next folks were coming in. So there was some internal conflict for sure, which directly reflects the movement at the time and some of the breakages and cracks in, say, the queer movement in the 70s and 80s.
And did any of that come across in the show?
Occasionally, yes. So I think it's always funny talking back to some of the lesbian activists from that era, the way that they might talk about, you know, the boys from the coming out show. So think about the language use in talking about folks in community. So the boys, even if they were in their 40s, let's say at the time that they were doing the show, and this kind of given that they had a different perspective on the world and a different community, a very specifically gay community that needed to be showcased on that show, that didn't have the same focus or interests as the lesbian community at the time.
I want to listen to the archives the same way they aired on the, like, that day's gay show and that day's lesbian show.
Yeah, there's some specials where they did, like, shows together, a two-hour block special. You can listen to those.
Well, listening back to these early radio shows, and now you're listening to a lot of podcasts, what would be your overall sense of how queer media has changed over the years?
Just a small question. I mean, queer media today has just, it's been changing with the nuances of queer community. LGBTQ as an umbrella was made with a specific purpose. Before that, it was just lesbian and gay. Then it was lesbian and gay and bisexual, you know, and it's grown to include and be more nuanced in what sort of identities you can have. And I think we see that directly reflected in the sort of media you can find made by queer community as well. I do think the word queer has lost some of its punk rock political charge that it used to have in, say, the 90s as a term of reclamation. But maybe that is just what happens, right? With repetition of terms that might be politically charged at one time in history, not so politically charged now, and now have become more just a simple identity umbrella for folks who maybe don't identify specifically with gay or lesbian or bisexual. So yeah, I think we're in an interesting time where there's a lot more mainstream representation too. A lot of musicians, for instance, coming out, there's not as much backlash anymore and risk involved anymore like there was in the, say, 80s and 90s to come out as a musician or an actor, for instance.
We often, I think, don't give, or at least I don't, give enough play and enough attention to these different ways of simply organizing, right? And you've mentioned it here and there, you know, throughout this interview, of doing it as a collective and under with these feminist values. And I wonder, can we have you tease that out a little bit more and sort of kind of express explicitly, like, what are some of those values and why does it take time, and why would this differ from how maybe there's just the default in Canadian or in American culture?
Yeah, I think a lot of media these days, and not everything, of course, there's lots of really great, thoughtful media being made too, but a lot of media that we consume, especially in the journalistic world, is media that has to be made quickly, and it has to be made with a particular story and a particular purpose in mind. And sometimes that means we have to, and I'm speaking from my own past experiences too, kind of gloss over some of the ethical concerns of what's being done in the process of making that work. And I think what feminist thought and feminist collective work can bring to the table is telling us it's okay to slow down. It's okay to really consider across identities. You know, if I'm, as I am, the white woman in the room at a table of other queer folks who maybe are coming from other racial or cultural backgrounds, am I taking up too much space? I shouldn't be. If I am, I'm going to step back. And that's the same way that if you're taking a feminist approach to your audio production, you're thinking about that not only in the conversations that you're having, but also in the edits that you're making. Who's driving your story? Who's the main voice in the work that you're making? Who are the musicians that you're using and hiring to make your soundtrack? It comes in at a lot of all of the levels across the board in your production process.
And what does it mean to be a collective? It's a word I think we hear often, and people have a, you know, we all have a sort of a general sense of what that means, but what does it mean when it comes to producing a weekly radio show or weekly podcast to do so as a collective?
Yeah. I mean, ideally it means it's non-hierarchical, but in practice, it usually means there's two or three people. Let's say, you know, my Fem Radio collective at the time, there was about 20 people involved, you know, in different levels, and whether they could come every week or whether they could come once a month or once every other month. But there was really about three of us usually at the time that were the core of the collective. And those are the people who are really, you know, actively making sure you're encouraging others to get involved, actively organizing, making the spreadsheets about what the episodes are going to look like moving forward, the typical work that, say, producers would do on a regular radio show, right? So you'll have collective members in that role. But it's also about encouraging and making sure other people who aren't as comfortable in those roles have the opportunity to try it out and to get the skills that they need to try that out within the collective, because it is non-hierarchical. So I shouldn't be the producer on every single episode, right? Which is not the model when we look at traditional media industry. There's a boss, you have a supervising producer, you have your juniors maybe, and you have your host, and they all have their separate distinct jobs. Whereas collectives tend to rotate and kind of see who has ideas in the mix at the time. Yeah, I think arts collectives in particular are good to look at as examples.
Thanks again to our guest, Stacey Copeland. A longer version of today's episode is available on our podcast, which is online at radiosurvivor.com or wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Eric Klein. Jennifer Waits produced today's episode. Paul Reese-Mandel is co-host. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week.